Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, author Clara Kumagai discusses her debut young adult novel, Catfish Rolling. The following conversation originally took place October 28th, 2023, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. Quick note, during this episode, Clara references photos from a slideshow she shared during the live in-person program. You can view these photos by visiting the American Writers Museum YouTube channel.
Thank you all for coming. My name is Gary Cranston. I'm the president here at the American Writers Museum. How many of you have never been here before? Shame on you. No, I'm kidding. Thank you for coming tonight. We're glad you're here. We are always thrilled to work with the Irish Consulate's office, and this is a wonderful program at a wonderful time of year for us. So with that, I'm going to hand things over to the Consul General of Ireland, Kevin Byrne.
Kerry, thanks so much. Hi, everyone. Thanks so much to Kerry and the American Writers Museum. It's always a joy to come here. My last time I came here, I was here with the Irish ambassador. We had an extremely busy program, and we'd given 1 hour to the American Writers Museum. 1 hour and 45 minutes later, I was furiously apologizing and texting everybody because she fell into the exhibition. So make sure you come back. It's an absolutely wonderful resource here in Chicago. You're most welcome to this first of two events that we're running this weekend for Halloween. Because Halloween, as you all may know, and if you don't know, you now know, is a traditional Irish festival. It finds its roots in Samhain, which was a Celtic pagan festival that the Irish celebrated back in the day. We're taking it back, as you can see, Ireland, home of Halloween. Clara Kumagai is from Canada, Japan, and Ireland. Her fiction and non-fiction has been published in The Stinging Fly, The Irish Times, and The Kyoto Journal, among others. She is a recipient of the We Need Diverse Books Mentorship, and this year she is also a winner of this year's Irish Arts Council, which is our equivalent of the NEA, the National Endowment of the Arts, Next Generation Artists Award. Catfish Rolling is her debut novel and already has been shortlisted for the Great Reads Award, and it's been named one of the best young adult books of 2023. It was published in Ireland in March and here in the US just in the last number of weeks. She's currently working on her second book. Clara, please, can you put your hands together? Thank you.
Hey, great. Thank you so much, everybody, for coming here today. Huge thank you to the American Writers Museum for having me, even though my American connection might not be totally clear yet. Thank you so much to the Irish Consulate in Chicago. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you so much, Sandra. So my name is Clara Kumagai, and what I'm going to do today is I'm going to do a short reading from the book. I'm going to talk about some of the inspiration, some of the real life inspiration behind the novel. And I'm also going to talk about the folklore and the myth that inspired it. And if maybe this sounds scary, but I'm going to ask you to participate. You don't have to talk to me though, you can talk to each other. But I want us maybe to think a little bit about how we think about legends, how we think about monsters and figures in folklore. And yes, as Kevin said, I am from Canada, Ireland, and Japan. I was born in Vancouver, and I and my family moved to Ireland when I was around 5 years old. So I lived in a few different places in Ireland. I lived in Cork for a couple of years, where I did get a strong accent, but you can't hear it anymore. But I was really pleased to hear that Cook County is partnered with Cork. Another thing that Cork can claim, which Cork is always happy to do, I think. And I also was mostly raised in County Galway, and Galway is twinned with Chicago. And one more American connection is that my parents, they're both chefs, they're retired now, but they actually met while they were working here in Chicago in the Drake Hotel. Oh, yes. So you can see why I definitely deserve to be here in the American Writers Museum today. I'm going to do a short reading, and I'm going to read the prologue, and then I'm going to read a bit from the end of the first chapter. This is just some background about the book before I do the reading. So the novel Catfish Rolling, it's set in Japan. It's set 7 years after an earthquake, and this earthquake was so huge that it actually broke time itself. And Sora is the main character of Catfish Rowling. She's Japanese-Canadian, and she lost her mother in the earthquake. Most of the novel takes place 7 years after this earthquake, but there are lots of moments where there are memories and flashbacks as well. So Sora, her father is a scientist, her father is Canadian, and he's studying a lot of these places where time has been broken. These are called the time zones, and in these places, time runs faster or slower than normal, and it's too dangerous for people to live there as a result. But her father is researching this, and as a result, he is becoming ill. And something that Sora does, like on her journey in the book, is try to find out how she can help him. Sora herself also goes into these time zones, and in these places, there are spirits, there's strange shadows, there are some of those figures from folklore. And while she's there, she's still searching for her mother. Okay, so let's see. I'm going to read the prologue first. There's a catfish under the islands of Japan. That's what shakes everything up. The catfish twisting and turning in the mud beneath us. It rolls and the ground trembles. Water crashes, time cracks and breaks. I hate that fucking catfish. Okay, so this is the end of chapter one, and this is sort of remembering when this huge earthquake took place. So she's with her father, and the earthquake just happened a little bit before this. And then something happened. I didn't know what it was then, only that something had shifted in a way that had never taken place before. Like the texture of the air thickened, or the temperature dropped, or the lights went out, except it wasn't any one of those things. It was the sensation of things switching, moving, fracturing. Dad felt it too. He lowered the phone from his ear, and everybody around us paused, steadying themselves against each other or cars or the ground. On the radio, there was a sudden silence. It felt as though the world had stopped, and for a handful of heartbeats, we all floated, suspended in space. My ears popped, and then gravity or momentum returned with a whoosh, like a huge wave breaking over the land. We were all thrown about, some backward, some forward, because it wasn't water or wind that had crashed over us. It was time. I think I fainted then because it was all black, and when my memory started again, Dad was holding me in his arms, even though I was too big for them. I stared up at the sky and saw that something was very wrong. The clouds looked like they had been shattered or cut by some gigantic knife. Over the buildings, smoke was trailing, but plumes right beside each other were rising faster and then slower, as if they were being tugged by different currents of air. I felt dizzy and sick, and I buried my face in Dad's chest. He put me on my feet. We have to go somewhere safer to wait. He held my hand and he walked so fast I had to jog to keep up. We weaved through cars and people and I focused on the ground because I didn't want to see the nightmare sky. I noticed that my other hand was empty. I'd lost the ice cream I'd picked out for Mom. I shouted and Dad turned to me. What's wrong? I twisted out of his grip and started to run back toward the car. But there are so many people coming towards us, all trying to get away, that I was tangled up in legs and rushing bodies. Dad was yelling at me, but I couldn't stop and didn't, until I felt his arms grab me and lift me roughly. What are you doing? He shouted. He shook me hard. The ice cream, I said. It's for Mom. I lost it. It's for her. Maybe it was the shaking that did it, but my tears came loose and I was crying, and Dad hugged me and then, without a word, took my hand again, and we made our way back up the hill with everyone else, trying to escape from whatever had happened behind us. We had been shaken. Our entire world shook. Okay, so I'll stop there. Oh, thank you. Okay, thank you so much. That's just a little kind of taste of what the book is like. And what I'm going to do first is I'm actually going to talk about the real life inspiration behind this book before I go into the myth and folklore. And that's just because I think it gives good context and I think it's pretty interesting. So part of the book, well, a big part of the book is inspired by the 2011 Great East Japan earthquake. And this was something that I kind of watched in the news at the time, and I was living in Ireland at the time, and it was really frightening to watch this you know, watch all this footage from the tsunami, from the earthquake, and also some of the fallout from the nuclear disaster as well. And at the time, we were trying really hard to like contact our family in Japan, and very luckily, all our family was fine. But my uncle was in Sendai at the time, and he said afterwards that he thought like this was it. He thought he was going to die, but luckily, he was fine. But of course, a lot of people weren't. And I lived in Japan for 5 years. I actually just moved back to Ireland in March. And while I was there, I did visit lots of places in Tohoku. So Tohoku is the northeast of Japan. And it's made up of different prefectures. And the coastal ones, of course, were the most affected by the earthquake and then, of course, the tsunami. So this is Rikuzen Takata. It's the youth hostel. And basically, they've kept it more or less how it has been since the earthquake and tsunami happened. In the background, you can see a tree, and this is called the miracle pine, because before the tsunami, there was all pine trees in this area. And the tsunami destroyed almost all of them except for this one. So it was called the miracle pine. It was a really important sort of symbol of hope and resilience. And unfortunately, because of the salt water, it did later die, but they've managed to preserve it still. And it was important for me in the writing of this book as well to kind of visit a lot of these places. This is the Kesennuma City Memorial Museum. And this was a school. They've sort of turned it into a museum. Now, very fortunately, everybody in the school made it out okay. But you can see this is a lot of the debris from the tsunami. And the scale might be a little hard to tell here, but that's like the third floor. The top of that car there is around the third floor of the building. And actually, if you go into this museum, there's another car inside the school that's on the fourth floor that was washed there by the tsunami. And a lot of people think of the earthquake as being, I guess, like the big thing that happened, but it was actually the tsunami that claimed more lives afterwards. And this is the Iwate Tsunami Memorial Museum. This is actually in Rikuzen Takata, and they have a memorial there, which is, you know, very beautiful. And the thing about Tohoku is that it is a really beautiful place. The coastline is gorgeous. I found the people there like really friendly and kind, and there really is a huge spirit of resilience there from people who, you know, have lived there for generations and continue to live there after the tsunami and the earthquake. So this is, you know, this is what inspired the earthquake of the book. Something that you probably noticed that I explained as well was the element of time. In the novel as well. And the time part is kind of the magical realist part, or as I've been calling it, magical science, because there is sort of scientific method and physics involved, but I'm not really good at that, so the magic part comes into the things I couldn't really understand or explain myself. But something that is really quite arresting is there's quite a few different examples of clocks around the Tohoku region. The tsunami hit the land, I think it was like 3:42 or something. So a lot of the clocks have been stopped. You can see here. This is also in Kesennuma. This is an art, a museum, the Rias Art Museum. So you can see, depending on where people were, the clocks are kind of stopped at different times. But this was a really interesting and moving part of the time inspiration that came into the novel. And the earthquake that struck in March 2011 was the biggest one ever recorded in Japan. And it was actually so big that it tilted our whole planet on its axis. After this, the Earth spun faster, and it made our year shorter by about 1.8 microseconds. So this is a, you know, it's a tiny, tiny amount, but the earthquake itself, you know, changed our planet and changed how time passes for us. And I, you know, when I learned that first, it really felt like science fiction, but it's just science. It is just science. But that really made the idea of time in this novel something tangible, something real. And then that helped it kind of become connected to the earth and to the land. These two photos were taken in Futaba, which is a town in Fukushima Prefecture. And you probably are familiar with the place, Fukushima, because of the nuclear disaster that happened as a result of the earthquake and tsunami. Something I like to point out about this is that I don't really like calling it the Fukushima disaster because this is a whole prefecture, a place where lots of people still live. The nuclear plant was a TEPCO nuclear plant, and that was where the disaster happened. Of course, the places near there were evacuated. So these two photos were taken in some of the evacuated areas. And that's where time sort of stopped there as well, in a different way. The exclusion areas have been empty since 2011, even though in some places people are able to move back. But this was another instance of where I saw time in a really kind of uncanny way. So this was someone's house, and this is inside, but you can see there's like moss growing up. I think that was tatami before, and you can kind of see nature taking over. There's ferns growing in there. There's whole buildings that are just being overgrown with vegetation. I'm not sure what this was. For some reason, I feel like this used to be a parking lot. But you can see there's a lot of sand, but the tracks, if you can see them, are made by boar. And while we were in this town, there was an announcement over the like tannoy system, and they were like, watch out, there's a bear in the area. But we didn't see the bear, it was okay. But this was sort of the uncannily beautiful thing about these areas, is that nature returned in this really vigorous and beautiful and lush way. So when I was there, you know, that really felt like time had speeded up almost. But sometimes you could see like clothes hanging up in windows, like shirts were ready to be worn the next day. And when you see those little snapshots, it felt to me like time had stopped or time had paused. So a lot of the exclusion areas kind of provided this inspiration for the time zones in the novel where time is running faster or slower. So that's all the real background for the novel. And all that stuff is pretty interesting, right? And it's all fact. Like I said, it is science. So you might wonder, like, why did I need to bring in the myth and folklore? Well, one reason is I really like it. And this is where I feel like a lot of the Irishness influenced me. And something I've always loved is folklore, myths, fairy tales. And I grew up with lots of these little stories. And the interesting thing is sometimes you would hear these from like neighbors or family members, and it would hardly even be a full narrative. It would be like an anecdote, right? And some of the creatures I grew up with, I chose the scarier ones because it is Halloween. And as we've clearly noted, Halloween is Irish. One of these is the puka. So I don't know if anyone is familiar with any of these. The puka is really interesting because it takes a lot of different forms. Ireland is not that big, but in Laois it's like a goblin, and in Waterford it's a black goat or something. Traditionally, or most commonly, I think we know it as a sort of devil horse. If you take a ride on its back, it will bring you on this wild ride, maybe to hell, maybe close by. And sometimes it's a trickster, sometimes it's benevolent as well. The Fargurta, this one was one my mother told me. I don't know if anyone's heard of this. This is an extremely terrifying image. My mother once said, I guess I was going through a growth spurt, I was eating a lot, and she said, it's like the Fargurta came on you or came onto you or passed through you or something. Some interesting phrase, and I didn't know what that meant. But the idea of this is like a spirit that's related to the famine. Sometimes it's connected to a piece of grass. And if you walk through this place, it's like the spirit of hunger, right, takes you over. And of course, the banshee, a really famous one, the kind of ghostly figure of a woman who screams in the night, and when you hear that scream, you know someone in the house is going to die. So I grew up with, I guess as I look at these, really quite terrifying figures. But this really inspired a lot of my storytelling, because I think what's interesting to me about folklore and fairy tales is that there's a lot of narrative kind of compressed into a very, very small story. I think they say a lot about culture. I think they say a lot about what we're afraid of. And they often contain sort of warnings, whether that's in ways to behave or not to behave. So, of course, I was also really drawn to figures of Japanese folklore. The tanuki, this is an image from Pompoko, the movie by Studio Ghibli. I love Ghibli movies. And also the kitsune. And of course, foxes all around the world have a sort of trickster status. And these ones, like some of the Irish folklore figures, are they good, are they bad? They could be both or either. Both of these spirits appear in the book, and they're shapeshifters. They change, they're mischievous, but they can do good as well as harm. So all of these figures were kind of what influenced a lot of my love of story and storytelling. Okay, so this brings me to the catfish. So the catfish under Japan, this is a pretty old story. The catfish in Japanese is called the Namazu. And the story goes that this catfish, you know, was causing all this trouble, causing earthquakes, until a god came down, sometimes called Kashima. And he came down, he put a big stone on the catfish's head, and he pinned it in place, right, to stop it moving around so much. And in Ibaraki Prefecture, there is a shrine for this god. It's called Kashima Jingu Shrine. And you can see here, this is a statue of the god and the catfish. You can even see the stone. It's about this big. And this really alarmed me when I saw it, because I thought, I don't know if that's really big enough to keep a whole giant catfish down. But it's said that someone, I guess, who thought similar to me, tried to figure out, you know, how deep does this stone go down? And he dug for 7 days and seven nights, and he did not find the bottom. So it goes down pretty far. Actually, after the earthquake in 2011, a lot of people actually went to this shrine to kind of pray for safety during earthquakes. And I think this is something really interesting in Japan, where often there's very old stories, very old myths and stories of folklore. And quite often you can go to these places and find some marker or some reminder of these stories. So something that I found, you know, a lot of great research material in was art. This is a lot of woodblock art. And this specific art about the catfish is called Namazu-e. Right, A meaning art, paintings. These are from around the Edo period. And there's lots of depictions of the catfish and how it's, you know, antagonizing people, how people are trying to fight back against it and defeat it. Here we can see lots of people. We can see men and women here fighting against it. And there's even a little small catfish, if you can see him. I feel like he's kind of cute. We have these images of the catfish, bringing this kind of fire, death and destruction. There's some other interesting imagery there, like the devil is pooping on that guy. Okay, this is just half of a larger image, but again, it's showing a lot of the same kind of conflict, right, between the huge catfish, between the people who are trying to live their lives and don't want this kind of destruction that the earthquake could bring. It's also good to note that around the Edo period, and really up until the 1920s in Japan, if there was an earthquake, a lot of the buildings were wooden, and it would cause a lot of fires. So when I was learning about the catfish in this way, I really saw the catfish as a figure that could cause a lot of destruction, certainly one that had many more negative aspects than positive ones. Also really made sense to me, this story of the catfish, because when I was in Japan and I felt an earthquake for the first time, well, first of all, I thought it was a ghost in my bed. But then when I realized what it was, it made me really feel and understand that the earth is alive, right? The idea that the earth could be living or moved by some living thing really made sense to me. And I think this is an instance where we see something from folklore as a way of trying to explain or understand the world around us. So the catfish really made sense to me. Okay, so what I'm gonna do is, this is the participation part. Again, because it's Halloween, we've got a spooky time of year. I'm talking a lot about tricksters and monsters. I want you to think about this as well. And I'm always really interested in what other people find scary. I'm always really intrigued to know, what stories were you told when you were growing up? What were you afraid of? I mean, that kind of sounds quite bad of me, actually. But I guess I'm interested in these stories and narratives. I'd like you to think of any kind of monster that scares you or used to scare you. If it still scares you, that's okay, and I really understand. But I'd like you to think about what makes this monster frightening, and importantly, what can it do? Okay, so if it's okay, I'm going to ask you to think about this. And if you want to talk to the person beside you, if you too are curious about the things that scare other people, it would be great if you could do that. Okay, hello. Everyone seems to be having a really good chat. But maybe if anyone's like particularly fearless, I actually usually have a few examples just in case you don't have things that scare you. It seems like from the sounds of it, people had things to talk about. But I just wanted to share a few. If you wanted some ideas of monsters, this is one of my favorites, Casa Obake. And yeah, so I don't know. Did everybody have things to talk about already? Yeah, okay. So if you want, you can just think about the Casa Obake, which means umbrella, ghost, spirit, I guess. Yeah, that was when I was really scared of when I was small. Even now, it's worrisome. So I guess if you'd like to, I'd love to hear any of the things, ghosts, monsters, anything that scared you when you were younger or scares you now. Oh yeah, great, thank you.
This may not ideally set the tone because it's not totally fearsome, but it was fearsome to me. I had two friends, Carmen and Linda, and we'd typically go home from school for lunch. We lived very close by, and my house was the closest, and we had a wood-burning stove. My job was to collect cobs to start the fire and then a heap of wood to carry it in. So in this woodshed we had, there was a big pile of cobs. And of course, that day I went in to get some cobs because we were short, and it happened that there was a ghost. Yes, a white sheet hovering. And I ran into the house and told my mother, I said, there's a ghost in here, there's a ghost out there, I can't get the cobs. And then my friends Linda and Carmen came into the house and they were giggling no end. They were so pleased they had scared me to death. And I'm 11 years old. I'm so embarrassed. I should be over this stuff. And my supposed friends betrayed me.
So, thank you. My takeaway from that is your friends were the monsters. That's true sometimes. Watch out. Thank you very much for sharing that. Does anyone else have any? Great. There's someone in the back.
I'll stand up. I used to live in John Singer Sargent's mistress's house. I was babysitting it while they were getting ready to renovate it. And I lived there with three other guys when I was in high school. And when no one was around, when it was just me in the house, I would wake up in the middle of the night, terrified in cold sweats for absolutely no reason. And this was 20 years ago. And we have since realized, we've told these stories to each other, that we all had that experience when we were alone in the house. That still chills. I don't know what the fuck was up with that. So. There you go.
Do you have any idea like who it was? Did you ever get a sense of anything?
It was the house that he bought for Madame X, who was the subject of one of his most famous paintings. Right. And I don't know what their relationship was like, and frankly,
probably not good.
If anybody here is an expert, don't tell me. I don't want to know.
Great. Okay. So that wasn't your friends playing tricks on you. No. Okay. Not that time. Does anyone else have any they'd like to share? Can I hear one more, maybe?
It's Dracula.
Okay. Oh, yeah. When did you hear the story of Dracula? Were you small?
Pretty young, but I used to have nightmares of Dracula climbing out of the coffin and coming after me.
Legitimately scary. Yes, thank you. Did you read the book, or was it from a movie or a TV show? TV show. Okay, interesting. Thank you. Okay. More monster.
I had the monster under the bed, which I was not scared of until someone told me that was a thing that occurred, and then I couldn't stop thinking about like something like coming, an arm coming up to grab me from under the bed,
and I would freak out about it until my mom sat down and told me a story about like the monster who lives under the bed and is terrified about the legend of humans that live on top of beds. And just like described it until it sounded like something soft and like, I was like, oh, I feel so bad for this monster now. And yeah.
Wow, good tactic from your mom. Great, thank you. Okay, thank you so much for sharing, everybody. The ghost story, it is good to do this exercise around Halloween because I love hearing people's personal ghost stories. And when I was in Japan, I taught in a university and I taught a bunch of different things. It was all in English, but something I like to get my students to do is to tell ghost stories. And it's great to hear someone who is still like developing like their grasp on a language tell a ghost story because there are amazing pauses. And it's really good because it lets your imagination work really well. But they told me some of the scariest things I've ever heard. And I enjoyed it and I did it every year. So I didn't learn my lesson with that either. And that's also just to note, I'm not very good at scary films or anything scary, but I just love hearing ghost stories. Okay, so thank you so much for sharing your monsters. So I showed lots of images of the namazu, the catfish, as this destructive figure through this art, the namazu-e. Something I also then found were some other quite different depictions of the catfish. And these were also in the same genre, right? The catfish art. These are also woodblock prints from around the same time. But this is a really different looking scene here. Some of these were actually created as satire. Something you'll see here is the catfish is there. He's being held down. And the people in the background are drinking, they're eating, they're being entertained. And actually, I should step out. Maybe you noticed I'm wearing a kimono because my obi also has some of this art on it. And also, I should just note, because it's Halloween, the kimono is not a costume I wear for Halloween. It is something that I wear relatively often, less often in Ireland. But I got this obi because I loved seeing this depiction of the catfish in terms of like fashion and style. So something we can see here is the catfish, who are much more anthropomorphized here, right? They look much more like people, are helping humans to escape from the wreckage. The satire, which was in the previous one, comes from the fact that people would always benefit after a disaster. I guess we'd call this now like disaster capitalism or something. So sometimes you would see different art where there's tradespeople, carpenters, builders, and merchants who are thanking the catfish because it's bringing them money, right, from rich to poor. There's some other ideas that because of this, the catfish would sort of create some kind of equality for a time, even though, of course, there are always still people who couldn't afford to rebuild, right? But this is why the catfish had this much more interesting side, that people didn't always think of the catfish as something evil and destructive. In the second one here that I'm showing, the catfish, also still pretty anthropomorphized, are building, this is a kanji, right? They're building this. One of the readings for this kanji is like flat or like a piece would be one reading of it. So when I was seeing a lot of this art, I was kind of beginning to think of the catfish, the sort of monstrous figure, in quite a different way. Something that just for me personally, I don't feel drawn to is the idea of a bad guy, per se. I can enjoy villains in lots of senses, but for me, when I'm writing characters, I'm not really interested in creating some sort of evil force or a force that is only creating something bad. In Catfish Rolling, I did have a character who was just sort of an antagonistic force, and it didn't feel right to me, and I ended up rewriting that character. And I think if there are any people who are writers in the audience or just who enjoy stories, I think this can be a great way of thinking about characters, thinking about character development and how to make, I guess we'd say, a rounded character. And this is something I kind of brought to all the characters in the book, you know, through learning about this through the with the catfish. Okay. And also the other thing is, in Japan, now, the catfish is still used as this symbol. And a lot of the depictions we see now are, again, not that negative. This sign confused me for a long time because I thought the catfish looked so friendly. It meant you should go down this road. I know it's written in Japanese and in English, but I was like, he seems so welcoming. This one is in Tokyo. So this is if there's a major earthquake, this is closed, if there's a major earthquake. So this would probably be one that is maybe close to water or be in the range of danger from a tsunami. This is a shrine in Tokyo, Kanda Myojin Shrine. And this is it's an omamori. It's like an amulet, like a charm that you can buy at temples or shrines that have different blessings or are protections or so on. And I bought this one at New Year's. This one is a disaster preventative. It's a catfish. And you know what? The catfish always looks sort of dorky when I see him these days. Like, I kind of really feel fond of him. There's also an earthquake app, which is the Yurekuru earthquake app. And catfish is a little icon. So this was, it gives you a little alert. This was, you know what? This was the day my book came out. I was in Ireland at the time, but I felt sort of anxious. I was like, did the catfish hear about the book? Is the catfish not so happy about it? But there was an earthquake that struck maximum intensity 3. The day I got my publishing deal, there was an earthquake as well then. So I feel concerned about... The catfish's literary interests or something. So something that we can see now in Japan is that the figure of the namazu is used in lots of different ways. And again, is kind of used almost in a protective sense, or I guess in a sense like acknowledging what it can do. And we kind of see it here as a sort of helper, I guess. Okay, so with that in mind, I'm going to ask you something else, which is to think about your monster or your ghost or your friends playing tricks on you, if you want. And if you're thinking about this from a character point of view, what might turn somebody or something into a monster? Can a monster do good? Can a monster truly be redeemed? I think something we see in maybe movies is a bad character who does something honorable and then dies. Right? That's something that I kind of associate with maybe more like superhero movies or like Star Wars or something. And I think that can be good to make you think about a bad guy differently. But I always think it would be way harder if like Darth Vader had to like sit down and be like, hey, I did some bad stuff, but I'd really like to rebuild our relationship. Like, that's way harder. And I know it's probably not as interesting for a movie, but I guess that's what I'm thinking. Like, can a monster actually be redeemed, and how do you do it? Like, can your future actions really make up for things you've done in the past? So again, I'd like you to think about these monsters or figures or stories that you already talked about. And I guess I'm kind of giving you a writing exercise, I suppose, which is to think about those monsters. Have you thought about the stories behind them and what you think might have made them that way? So yes, maybe you can talk to the people beside you again. Yeah, this is all backstory, I guess. So I'll give you a few minutes to talk about that. Thank you. Okay, hello again. So, yeah, I'm interested in if anybody found some sort of backstory or redeeming quality or something about their monster, a thing that scared them that, I don't know, makes them less scary or makes them more complicated. Would anyone like to share? Oh, yes.
So when we think about the banshee,
oh, yeah,
and we think about how society treats older women, and the question that we've been talking about a lot at home, my son's so excited I'm talking about this, is not like, what's the matter with you? It's what happened to you? And so I think the banshee is potentially kind of this collective figure of mistreating older women and how people always know when that's happening. Mm-hmm. And so there's that kind of gut feeling of like, this might backfire. Mm-hmm. This population, this archetype might come back for a pound of flesh. Mm-hmm. So like, we're scared of them because we know that we haven't treated them well. Nice. And so for the Banshee, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, that's great. And I think that's really interesting that that's then the story of the Banshee is so tied to mortality, right, as well, and like death and what that means. That's great. Thank you so much. Anybody else? Any other complicated monsters? I find like also this is a good trick if you do have anything that still scares you. This is actually, sorry, I'm not sure, a blue shirt person, that your mom did this actually. You should tell her that it's a great writing exercise. Oh, is she? Did she ever write about monsters or anything? Oh, really? Okay, cool. Yeah, tell her that's a good one. Yeah. Okay. Right. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to, because of time, move on. And what I'm moving on to is Q&A time. Yeah. So I don't mind if you have any questions, you can ask me about the writing process or research or storytelling or anything else that you want to know, please feel free to ask me. I think we've got some time for that.
Hello, I'm greenings from Canada.
Yes. Hi, Canada.
Well, I'm American and Canadian. I'm also, my mother's Irish. She's from County Clare.
Really?
Yes.
Sorry, I believe you.
No, I know, believe it or not. The black and Irish exist. I had a question about one of the main protagonists in the book, Sora. Mm-hmm. She's Hafu, correct?
Yeah.
And I was wondering, you know, obviously I can see the inspiration, but how does that play into the greater narrative? Mm-hmm. And I have one more question after that, sure. But yes.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. So yeah, Sora is Hafu, which in Japanese would just mean like your one of your parents is Japanese and one of your parents is from somewhere else. And Sora's mother is Japanese and her father is Canadian. For me, my father is Japanese and my mother is Irish, so it's opposite. But I think it was important for me to write a character like that because when I was growing up, I didn't see many characters like that, especially in Ireland. My godfather lived in Vancouver and he worked in library studies and he had a lot of friends who were children's writers. So any kind of diverse narratives I got actually were coming from like Christmas presents he would send me. But while I was growing up, there was very little diverse representations. If there were any, there wasn't that much written by people who had that identity, and that has a certain kind of damaging effect as well. So it was really important for me to have a character like that leading the book. For the overall narrative, I think something she's doing is trying to figure out her identity. A lot of people who are multiracial or like third culture kids or, you know, like even third generation of immigrants can kind of feel that sort of displacement or trying to figure out where you belong, or maybe you feel fine, but people are always asking you where you're from. And I think even if you don't have that as a teenager, there's a lot of like working things out. So that kind of trying to figure out who you are and your place in the world is like a very rich territory for storytelling. And that's why I like writing for young adults. For the book, it is set in Japan, but it was important for me to have other characters that represented different kinds of Japanese identity. So there is another character who is Hafu and Black. Her father's African American, and her father, but now I can't remember. That's just her backstory, but she is Black and Japanese because I have friends who are, and there's a particular kind of disbelief that you can be both of those things. And there's another character who's Zainichi Korean, which is someone who's ethnically Korean, but might have lived in Japan their whole lives, but even now are still treated not equal to Japanese citizens. And there's also a character who is Japanese American. She's Sansei. She's third generation Japanese. And I wanted to include that because I know people like that and because I think there's lots of different Japanese identities that I wanted to show as well. Yeah, that's a very long answer.
Sorry, I'm sorry. Just one brief final question
on
that. You mentioned identity quite a bit. And I'm wondering, just philosophical question, as multiracial people ourselves, do we have a culture of our own?
I think that's a really good philosophical question. And I think that's where it comes down to maybe individuality, or maybe even family, or the different kind of community you can build with each other. Like something in our family, as I said, my parents are chefs. Like at Christmas dinner, we have all the stuffing and duck or vegetarian quiche for me. But we'd also have like tempura and like sometimes miso soup. And that kind of for me is an example of how you just end up with a fusion of different things. So like for me and my family, that would be like our family culture, right? Being able to like eat those foods at the same time and it's normal and delicious. I think that it was really good for me to find other people who are multiracial in Vancouver. I went back there to do my MFA and I found a really rich, thriving Japanese Canadian community of people who have experienced lots of different things. Some people can speak Japanese, some people can't, some people are first generation immigrants, some people are fourth generation. So that was really important for me. And then I think your culture is sort of what you make it and what you relate to. So even like I'm wearing kimono now and I decided I wanted to learn that because I felt like it was sort of a tactile way for me to learn about an aspect of Japanese culture. And I learned a lot about kimono history and seasons and patterns and material, but I also like learned how I want to wear it, which this is a denim kimono, and I'm wearing my boots with it. So like I feel like that's also not uncommon, but that's like how I feel comfortable wearing something like this. So yeah, I guess. I didn't give you any real answer for that, but I gave you some possibilities. Yeah, thank you. That's a really great question. Any other questions? Yes.
Hello.
Hello.
So I was very impressed earlier on because you mentioned County Leash.
Oh, yeah.
Before County Waterford. So you said that the goblin is the Leash equivalent of the puka. So thanks for the shout out to Leash, where I'm from. We never get a shout out, so thank you for that.
Look, so one thing I always try and do, shout out Leash. Yeah, talking about underrepresentation,
exactly.
Leash.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So my question is, so you made me think about sense of place. Is there a place in Ireland that you would say is more superstitious or scarier than anywhere else? And maybe America as well. I was thinking of Salem's Lot, you know, and different places in America, but interested to know your take on the scariest place in Ireland.
I don't know if you've ever heard of the Ghost Bus Tour. But if you go on this bus tour in Dublin, I haven't been able to go on it yet, but it takes you around the scariest places in Dublin. I'd recommend that. Apart from that, it's hard to say. Like, I know there's different like haunted houses or haunted sites, but I think something that I always find haunting would be places like Cove, where people left for America. Often during the time of the famine or times of great hardship, and they would go on the ships called the coffin ships. And that, whenever I would learn those stories, that always had a very haunting feeling because that was real, and it's not really that long ago. I feel like anything like that has a fairy tree or a fairy fort, in Ireland, we always have these places. There's like, I feel like often like Hawthorne or Whitethorn or something. And it's in the middle of a field and often it's kind of on a mound, sort of. It's a little bit raised and rocky and you don't cut those trees down. Any building project you try to undertake by cutting those down, it's gonna fail. Someone's gonna be injured in some kind of accident. So I think there's all those places like that where they don't even have, I think this is what I meant earlier, like they don't even have one narrative. Like there's not a big important story about things like the fairy trees or the fairy forts, but it's something like that we learned as we grow up, right? You leave those things or those places alone. Great, thank you. Yes, hello.
Hi there. Thank you for sharing your process, and it's such an intellectual and thoughtful process. And I think we're very lucky to have received that information here. And I wonder, as you craft fiction and you produce a piece that you send out into the world, it doesn't necessarily for the reader come with all of that context. Yeah. And how do you feel as an author, how do you feel about leaving that and leaving what you've produced in hopes that we have the curiosity to learn more, but you produce a final product that is distinct, discrete?
I actually think I haven't thought about that so much. Now I feel a little sad. I actually really like doing events and meeting people and readers, and I think that's probably a big part of that, because I like talking about these different elements, and because I think a lot of them are, like, I feel important. But I think, you know, if you are writing fiction, and especially something like historical fiction, but even something like sci-fi or fantasy, there's a lot of other things that don't go into the book because you can't fit it all in. And that's just, you know, I think that's the nature of a story. Like in sci-fi or fantasy, if you open it and it's just like, here's how the sewage system works on this planet, like that's kind of fast. I mean, I guess I would be, I guess I'm sort of interested in that. But for a reader, like, you don't need to know all those things. It's amazing that a writer can know your world in that much detail, but the reader doesn't need to know that in order to enjoy a story or connect with characters. So I think it's just something that you have to let go of. And I guess there's that phrase, kill your darlings, which I don't always agree with, but sometimes there are things that you hold on to when you're writing and you think, like, I love this scene, or I love this, even this line, but is it really necessary to the story? Is it essential to the plot? Maybe not. And then you might have to edit it out or just, like, let it go. So I think that's the process of writing and rewriting and editing. And I guess something I found, like, after publishing the book is that I feel attached to the book in a different way, which is, I love meeting people who are reading it, and I realize they have a different relationship with the book than I have, and the book is out there by itself. And I don't really have any control over how people read it and think about it. And there's like a great joy in that as well. So you have to let it go, I guess. Yeah, thank you.
And with that, can we all say thank you so much?
Yeah, thank you.
For a wonderful program, and thank you so much for going into the detail of the book.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.